Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, September 15th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from CHP Berkshires, celebrating 50 years of commitment to caring for their community, serving more than 30,000 Berkshire residents each year. Primary care, women's health care, family services, dental, and more. CHPBerkshires.org. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. David Hart. Dr. Hart is a board-certified neurologist at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. He is here to answer your questions about Alzheimer's and a range of other neurological issues. We always get calls aplenty during this show. Call early. Get in line is my advice. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Or email voxpop@wamc.org. Back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today is Dr. David Hart. Dr. Hart is a board-certified neurologist at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany, where he sees general neurology and memory patients with a focus on Alzheimer's and other dementias. He's practiced in Albany since the early 90s, both in private practice and academic settings, and over the last 25 years has overseen numerous clinical trials in Alzheimer's disease, including studies of several recently FDA-approved and pending treatments which slow the progression of Alzheimer's. The number to call is 800-348-2551 if you have a question. 1-800-348-2551, or you may email us. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address, and the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart, welcome back. How's the summer?
Oh, it's been a great summer.
Yeah?
A lot going on, some beautiful weather.
Yeah, it's nice. I always like this transition time of year when fall is still warm enough for comfort. Before we get to the calls, anything new that you want to, whenever you're on, we talk about any new advances or trials or anything going on that you want to talk about that's brand new.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of good things to talk about. I was able to get up to the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Toronto in July.
Oh, nice.
That's the big international Alzheimer's conference, and there were a couple of really exciting pieces of information there. I guess first off, people are always asking me, you know, when I see patients for other reasons or the kids of my dementia patients or spouses of my dementia patients saying, what can I do? How can I, you know, prevent myself from getting it or lower my risk? And so the top line results from something called the Pointer study came out. And this was an intervention where they took a bunch of older folks who were cognitively normal and they followed them for several years' time. One group got sort of light coaching. They were advised to exercise a certain frequency, and they were pointed towards diet recommendations and things like that. And the other group had intensive intervention, and that group was given a health coach, and they had scheduled workout sessions 4 times a week. They had diet coaching. They were given repeated instruction in how to follow the MIND diet, which is kind of an adjustment of the Mediterranean diet, basically focusing on more fresh fruits, nuts, vegetables, more healthy oils, less red meat. And they did some cognitive training with them as well. And they found that after just a couple of years' time, that there was a significant cognitive benefit to the people who were up and out there, up and physically active with great regularity, who were being coached to stay on top of eating a healthful diet. And so, you know, these are the sort of things that you can do yourself. You can join the Y and you can work with a trainer, or you can just, you know, plan it out on your calendar when you're going to exercise. You can look at information on, you know, the DASH diet or the MIND diet or the Mediterranean diet, which are all very similar and all basically the same thrust of, you know, getting away from hyper-processed foods and eating, you know, the healthy stuff. And that this sort of thing, even over a short period of time, really can make a big difference for people.
Now, this Pointer study, how many years did it go?
It was 2 years of data that they released, and it is ongoing for another year or two.
So, having never done one of these studies before, how many people, both in the control group and in the other group, how many do you need to make it scientifically sort of worthy?
Well, the more patients that you have, the greater the power of the study and the greater the likelihood that even if you get a smaller difference, that you know that it's really most likely because of your intervention and not just chance. And so most of the Alzheimer's intervention trials are enrolling, 1,200 patients, 1,500 patients, 2,000 patients. The more people you enroll, the more time you follow people, the more costly it is, and the money, turns out, has to come from somewhere. But that seems to be the range where there's a significant payoff.
You know, it sounds like an interesting study because the one group was sort of, as you say, given light coaching and suggestions. How many people actually went to the mat and followed the suggestions? Did they have any data on that? In other words, you tell me, oh, you better get out there and do some exercise, I might say, sure, and yeah. I may sit on the couch and watch the Mets game.
So I think that the goal, and I should say that the Poynter study was based on a study from a few years back, the Finger study, which was the Finnish geriatric study, and was the first to really show this kind of intervention clearly having benefit. I think what they were trying to look at is if we have some regimen of you know, working with our patients or having people work with them and coach them along, does it really make more of a difference than if they just come in for a blood pressure check every 3 months and you say, you know, you shouldn't be eating so many cheeseburgers. Have it without the bacon the next time.
Yeah. Dr. David Hart is our guest today. He is with the Stratton VA Medical Center and is a neurologist who focuses on memory issues and dementia and Alzheimer's and stuff. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Before we get to the email bag and then the phones, Mind Diet, who came up with that little moniker?
I'm sorry, I don't know off the top of my head who it is that named it, but it was developed to be an adaptation of the Mediterranean
right.
diet in ways to make it a little bit easier for people to follow. Because the Mediterranean diet can be pretty strict.
So it's basically you're getting healthy fats and fruits and things like that.
Right.
Anybody can do that, right?
Yeah, anybody can, and it's important for people to learn that. Not everybody does, and that's where we get into trouble.
All right, let's go to the email bag, and we'll grab one or two before we hit the break, and then we'll go to the phones. Dr. David Hart is our guest. 800-348-2551 is our number. Ben in Providence checks in. Is the incidence of early onset Alzheimer's increasing, and if so, why?
I'm not aware that there has been any real increase in early onset Alzheimer's. And what we mean by that is onset before age 65. I think the overall incidence, meaning the rate per population of Alzheimer's, has actually been decreasing a little bit.
Interesting.
Because there are so many risk factors that we're starting to modify. Vascular risk factors play a big role. So having people keep their blood pressure under control, having people have less strokes, having people keep their diabetes under control is healthier for the brain, and that lowers the incidence of Alzheimer's. So early onset Alzheimer's is just onset before age 65. That's about 1% of people with Alzheimer's. About half of that group, more or less, has a single gene mutation that causes it. And if you have that gene, then you're definitely going to get Alzheimer's, probably at the same early onset age that whichever parent you got the gene from got it. But that's a very, very small proportion. And as I say, I'm not aware of there being any evidence that rate is going up.
So early onset, the 1% of all cases, right? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
And then 50% of those have that mutation, that gene issue, right?
Right.
Philosophically, ethically, if money was no object, would you recommend that everybody have a DNA test?
No.
Why?
Well, first off, because it would be an extraordinary expense. Secondly, if we came up with, we tested 100 people, when we find Ray, unfortunately, was not your lucky day, and you came up positive, what do we do about that? Not a lot different
well,
from what
we're
already
doing. Well, I take
the
Mind Diet. I mean,
but you should be doing that anyway because, like the rest of us, you're collecting birthdays, and you know that's a big risk for developing a dementia.
That's hurtful.
Well, you know, it's.
But I said if money was no object, you say it's a colossal expense to do that. Taking money off the table, does that change your thinking?
Well, there's the ethical consideration of you give somebody a diagnosis. what do they do with that diagnosis, or what do you do for them with that diagnosis?
But I thought early treatment was the key to extending it and slowing the progression.
Yeah, but you're not talking about – so early symptomatic treatment right now is the state of the art. And what you're talking about is pre-symptomatic treatment. And we may get there. There are a number of studies. There have been some studies done already which unfortunately haven't shown benefit for people who were from a like the DIAN network, the Dominantly Inherited Alzheimer's Network. It's a group of families that are known to carry these genes and that are studied very carefully and are participating in many of these kinds of trials. So we really need to show that we can benefit these folks before we start putting them on things which may carry significant risk.
Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll hit the phones with Dr. David Hart. It's neurology today. It's Alzheimer's. It's memory issues, dementia. We'll be back with your calls at 800-348-2551. Lockbox is open, people. If you haven't made a pledge so far, you could certainly shorten our October 6th fund drive by making your pledge right now. It could be any amount from a dollar up to a zillion dollars, whatever's comfortable for you. WAMC.org to make that pledge. We'll keep this thing going together. WAMC.org. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff here. Dr. David Hart over there. Dr. Hart is a board-certified neurologist at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. He focuses on Alzheimer's and other dementias. And let's begin in Hudson, and it looks like it's Armin. Armin, go ahead.
Yes. Hi, doctor. My question is about Bell's palsy. I'm not sure if you are that's within your area of expertise.
But, absolutely.
On January 2nd, I had experienced the onset of Bell's palsy. I started out with acupuncture treatments for a period of about 1 month with electricity. Then I proceeded to do exercises prescribed by a physical therapist, also taking some supplements, magnesium, and alpha-lipoic acid to stimulate nerve growth. Now I'm over 8 months into my Bell's palsy. I've regained maybe possibly 80%, 75 to 80% of my facial muscle usage, but the corner of my mouth is still not completely healed. I have a little bit of a speech defect. Water dribbles out the side of my mouth when I drink. My face is a little bit contracted in the morning when I wake up, and when I do the exercises, the muscles relax, and then my face resembles a normal shape. But when I smile, for example, my left side of my mouth does not smile as far as my right. So my question is, what is the prognosis for someone who's 8 months or more into Bell's palsy, and what do you recommend?
Well, first off, a little bit of background for the listeners. Bell's palsy is a paralysis of what we call the muscles of facial expression on one side of the face. It's a nerve that comes off the base of the brain, and it has one of the longest transcranial courses of any of the nerves. So rather than just kind of poking into the inside of the skull and then popping out on the other side, outside of the skull, it pokes into the inside of the skull at the base of the skull, and then it travels forward through a long twisting tunnel. And if you get a viral inflammation of the nerve in that tunnel, the tunnel is a bony canal, and it's not able to expand to give the nerve more room. And so it's as if somebody reached in and pinched the nerve physically at that site. Most often, Bell's palsy is associated with a viral infection. I think the thinking is still human herpes virus type 6 is the most common cause, but the shingles virus can cause it. Other viruses can cause it. Other illnesses can cause it. And then there are two kinds of damage that can occur. You can damage the nerve fibers themselves, the axons, which is a more severe kind of damage and is very hard to recover from, or you can damage just the insulation on the nerves. And that's something that the body is much more able to repair and has a much higher rate of successful regrowth. So at 8 months into it, if you're 80% or somewhere in that range improved, I think there's some significant chance that over the next 3 or 4 months you may see some further significant improvement. If you were 8 months into it and you had very little recovery, then unfortunately I think the likelihood that you're going to make a meaningful recovery would be pretty small. And then there are sometimes some more aggressive interventions that can be looked at, like something called a hypoglossal transposition, where a surgeon moves a nerve from the base of the tongue and grafts it onto the stump of the facial nerve to let that nerve fiber grow out and start controlling the muscles
wow.
around the mouth or around the eye or things like that.
Armin.
Yeah. Yes, I experienced this as a result, or not as a result, but simultaneously with the molar extraction. The lower left molar was cracked, had to come out. That same day, my face went numb. Not went numb, but went paralyzed. And so I know that the cause could have been a viral infection that maybe pre-existed the molar situation. I don't know. No one knows, and no doctor has been able to tell me. And I'm frankly kind of mystified at the lack of expertise. Well, many of the medical professionals that I've seen about Bell's palsy and, you know, what I can do. I seem to have stumbled upon a kind of a dead end here, but your explanation is very similar to what I've heard.
Right.
So I guess my I'm still concerned about my further prognosis for recovery. And well, if you think there's hope, then I'll just keep doing my exercises and see what happens.
I think you're doing the right thing.
Thanks, Armin. Appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. David Hart joins us. Bell's palsy is a very interesting one. Now, this nerve, you say, is a kind of a long circuitous route to do what it has to do, right? Is that...
Yeah, it comes off of the brain stem, which is the junction between the spinal cord and the hemispheres of the brain. So it comes off at the brain stem and it travels forward, travels with the nerve to the inner ear. They dive into what's called the internal auditory meatus, which is a groove-like opening at the base of the skull, and then they twist around. The eighth nerve jumps out to get to the inner ear, and the seventh nerve comes out kind of just in front of and below the ear and behind the angle of the jaw, branches out to go to the forehead, the muscles around the eye, the muscles that you voluntarily control.
Interesting. You know... You say it's the canal basically becomes constricted, sort of like stenosis?
Well, it's not that the canal constricts. It's that the nerve swells. And when the nerve swells, the canal, which was plenty big enough before, now becomes too tight because it's a bone, and so bones can reshape only very, very slowly, and it can't do that over a couple of days' time to give the nerve room.
So the nerve damage usually will repair itself, or is there treatment, regular treatment, not extensive intervention, as you mentioned, but sort of standard treatment?
Right. The big thing is to get people in right away. So if you are experiencing this at home, number one, it's important to make sure, have somebody who knows, make sure that it is a Bell's palsy and it's not a sign of a stroke.
Right.
Number two, if it is Bell's, then the standard of care at this point is usually to give people a short course of steroids and an antiviral. So the steroids reduce inflammation, and the antiviral, if it is caused by the virus that treats, helps to stop that infection, both ways of keeping a more mild case of nerve injury from becoming a more severe one.
So interesting. Dr. David Hart joins us. 800-348-2551 is our number. Joan is in Greenwich, New York. Joan, you're on.
Hello. Just need to adjust the volume on my phone a little bit.
Okay.
I'm 74 years old. I have some risk factors for dementia, including multiple head injuries. And most of my relatives died more or less too early to get Alzheimer's. My mother had it, but she lived into her 90s. I had COVID in late May, and I had a lingering cough, which resolved. But I have a couple of things that haven't resolved. One is bouts of fatigue, but the other is my cognition seems to have declined. I have what feels like brain fog. mostly trouble with name and word recall, which I realize in and of itself is not necessarily terribly problematic as you age. But I'm just wondering, I'm going next month for the yearly wellness exam offered through my primary's office. And I take something called the MoCA test every time, and I'm going to be doing that again. But I'm just wondering, if I don't do as well, is there a way to distinguish Alzheimer's or other dementia from COVID brain fog, you know, long COVID?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, I think. First off, we know that the coronavirus that causes COVID causes inflammation in a lot of different places in the body. We know for sure that it can cause cognitive difficulties for a lot of people who are infected with it. I don't think anybody has pinned down exactly what the mechanism of that is. And part of the problem is that you have people who are having some cognitive difficulties. They're having some functional impairments, but they're overall fairly healthy. And so you don't open them up and take a chunk of brain out to look at it under a microscope to really get an answer as to what has gone wrong. And so you have to have good non-invasive ways of figuring that out. But the cognitive difficulties from COVID should be like the cognitive difficulties from a concussion or something like that, should be something that is fairly maximal around the time of the event and then either remains stable or gradually improves. If you have a progressive decline, then that suggests there's something else going on, whether that is Alzheimer's or vascular dementia or your thyroid is underactive or you have a vitamin deficiency or something like that. So if your doc is doing the MoCA, that's great. The MoCA is a very good screening tool. But if you're showing a progressive decline, then you have to figure out what it is that's doing that. And I wouldn't attribute that to the COVID infection.
Joan, thanks a lot. What's the MoCA test?
Stands for Montreal Cognitive Assessment. And so it's a cognitive tool. It takes about 10 minutes to do. It's pretty easy to learn how to administer it. And it was specifically designed to pick up people who have mild cognitive impairment rather than some of the other tools that are out there that were just designed for looking at people who have really severe impairments. When those are used as a screening tool, they're very often misleadingly normal because they're not built to look at people with mild deficits.
So is this how doctors in your profession set baselines for patients?
Yeah, that's one good way of doing that.
Would you recommend everybody have that?
Well, you know, it depends on how much time your doc has when you go in for an annual visit to do
not
the MoCA.
Not much anymore,
takes,
huh?
Right. So unless you're lucky enough to have somebody who's got a staff member who, you know, a nurse or a tech or somebody who's learned how to do the MoCA and knows how to do it well, MoCA actually has a certification of examiners, so you can be sure that you know what you're doing or that the person who's giving you as a patient the MoCA knows what they're doing, because, you know, a lot of it has to be interpreted. And you have to know exactly how to administer it for the numbers to be meaningful numbers.
Our guest today is Dr. David Hart from the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. We talk about memory and neurology and Alzheimer's, other dementias as well. 800-348-2551. That's the number. VoxPop at WAMC.org is the email address. And Mark in Schenectady says, I'm wondering what connection exists, if any, between the consumption of GMO food products as well as the accumulation of microplastics in the human body and Alzheimer's disease and Lewy body dementia.
As far as microplastics, I think the data is very preliminary but is certainly concerning that there are these microscopic plastic fragments that, you know, are ubiquitous in our environment and end up in all kinds of bodily tissues, and that's probably not a good thing. I think we're too early in the course of people looking into that to really know how much of a problem it is and what specifically it does or accentuates, what processes it interferes with, and what specific diagnoses, if any, it is tied to. As far as GMOs, those are genetically modified organisms. And a lot of people are concerned about having foods that are genetically engineered, and there is certainly the potential for a catastrophe when things are manipulated, but I'm not aware of any cases of the food supply using GMO foods that has led to problems. And maybe the technology is just being used to increase the protein content in a grain or to increase drought resistance or things like that. And, you know, those are lofty goals.
Mike writes in along those lines, what common medications are known to contribute to dementia or Alzheimer's? I refer to low dose of gabapentin.
Medicines that accumulate in the brain can cause cognitive difficulties. So things like the benzodiazepines, which are medicines like Valium and Ativan, lorazepam, Versed. These are short-acting sedating medications, but they are fat-soluble, and that means they cross out of the bloodstream and into the brain where they can accumulate. And so if somebody uses something like that for anxiety, and they're supposed to use it, you know, three times a day if needed, but instead of using it a couple of times a week just when they really need it, people lean on it more and more, that can build up in the brain, and that can cause problems, and that can look like a dementia. Gabapentin, especially at low dose, gabapentin is usually fairly rapidly cleared. It doesn't undergo much metabolism, so it's not really broken down in the liver. It's excreted relatively unchanged in the kidneys. So if people have kidney disease, then you have to be very careful with it. But it's a fairly short duration medication, and so it tends not to accumulate in the central nervous system. It doesn't mean if somebody's taking massive doses that couldn't cause cognitive difficulties, but for low dose, it's usually not that much of a concern.
Mike has a second part, and this I think is specific to Stratton VA. As a veteran, how can I partake in any studies? Are any vets eligible to get evaluated for Alzheimer's or dementia at the VA? I'm 72. I've had COVID twice. One of my two brothers, 8 years older than I, had dementia and is deceased. And that's from Mike.
Yeah, so that's a great question. The amount of research that different veterans hospitals is doing varies. We're doing a couple of basic studies at this point. We're collaborating with a researcher at UAlbany on a diagnostic test using a laser technology. And so that's something that our research institute at Stratton is involved in and that I'm helping out on peripherally. So contacting our research institute is one way. As far as within the VA system, I'm not sure what the next best way to find out elsewhere is, but the Boston VA has a very large dementia program, and so Dr. Budson runs the program there. He'd be a great person to contact. There's the Alzheimer's Association's Trial Match service, which helps to connect people, not specifically veterans, but connect people in general with clinical trials.
This study you guys are doing involving a UAlbany researcher, it is using lasers in some way to diagnose dementia?
Right. It's based on the concept that if you shine a laser through a blood collection, the different proteins bounce the light in different directions and may refract it in different ways. And so the blood sample from one person will have a different reflective signature than the blood sample from another person. And this is trying to identify if there's a specific reproducible signature that's indicative of Alzheimer's disease.
That is cool. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, go ahead.
Are the entanglements seen with Alzheimer's, not seen with other forms of dementia?
The entanglements.
You're probably talking about the neurofibrillary tangles?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a bunch of different tauopathies. There are a bunch of different brain diseases that are associated with changes in tau protein, the frontotemporal dementias, corticobasal syndrome, Alzheimer's disease. So tau pathology is not specific to Alzheimer's. Amyloid pathology is relatively specific to Alzheimer's.
All right, Jim, we got to take a break here, but thank you for the call 800-348-2551 is our number. VoxPop@WAMC.org is the email. We'll be back with Dr. David Hart. I love this record. That's from Nelson Esposito and Quintana, and that's Blind Cat Blues here on Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Dr. David Hart joins us from the Stratton VA Medical Center. All right, you ready for a stupid question? You ready?
Hit me.
Do pets get dementia? It's a two-parter. First part is, do pets, can animals of any stripe get dementia?
I have pets, but I don't treat them. do pets get Alzheimer's? I would say no, absolutely not.
How do you know?
Because Alzheimer's doesn't seem to happen in most other animals. There's no, for example, we do a lot of trials on mouse models of Alzheimer's, but mice and rats don't actually get Alzheimer's.
So
a mouse model or a rat model depends on us implanting a gene that makes them overproduce amyloid. Is usually the way that it's done. So we were talking a minute ago about amyloid is specific to Alzheimer's. And so we put a gene into these animals to make them overproduce amyloid protein in the brain, and that can cause something that looks like the amyloid plaques of Alzheimer's disease. And so that's a model for treatment trials and things like that.
So you can use animals for studies.
You can, but you have to understand that this is an animal model. And so it's giving you some information, but it's not people, and their brains are not quite the same as ours. They're alike in some very important ways, but they're dissimilar enough that what works in a mouse doesn't necessarily work in humans, and you can't directly translate success in a mouse trial to what we should be doing for humans. So we were talking briefly during the break about the paper on lithium that came out over the summer.
Yes.
This is a paper in the journal Nature, I think, published last month. And it was based on some recent work that has suggested that, number one, lithium is an important molecule, an important element for proper brain functioning. Number two, that areas of brain tissue where amyloid plaques exist seem to not have enough lithium in that area.
Huh.
And then number three, there's a mouse trial that was just published treating mice with small doses of a particular form of lithium called lithium orotate and finding that this had some cognitive benefit for those mice. So it's fascinating stuff. It's really great basic science information. And if it goes through all of the subsequent layers of research and continues to show promise, then maybe that'll be something that a few years down the road will be ready for clinical application. But at this point, putting somebody on lithium to treat Alzheimer's disease doesn't seem like a great idea to me. Lithium is a cumbersome medicine to use. It's been used for migraine prevention in neurology. It's been used for treating bipolar disease for decades. But a lot of people feel crappy on lithium. There's some important interactions to watch out for. And so it's not something that you can just say, oh, look, this worked in mice. I'm going to put my patients on it, or I'm going to buy it off the internet and do it to myself. That's not a good idea.
Well, you know, I was a kid in the 70s, but I seem to recall lithium was fairly ubiquitous as far as people who had, I don't know, depression or you said bipolar or whatever.
Right.
So it was out there a lot.
Yeah.
Is there a way for a forensic study to be done based on the incidence of Alzheimer's in all those folks from the 70s who were on lithium for other reasons?
There is some tantalizing data suggesting that some of those folks who were on lithium for other reasons may have had a lower risk of developing dementia.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of things pointing towards that possibly being a real mechanistic finding, but we have to flesh it out. We really need to get some good prospective human-level data. I always tell people that there are so many things that look great even in phase one human trials that when they get to phase two and phase three, they crash and burn. And so you really have to do the work to find out if it's something that is safe and if it's something that is effective.
Would you rather do studies and research, or would you rather continue treating patients?
My real enjoyment in life is getting to know people, getting to learn their problems and trying to help out with them. It's a real privilege, and I love doing that. was very, very happy to be involved in the clinical trials that I was part of over the last couple of decades. But if I had to choose one versus the other, it is seeing patients for sure.
Dr. David Hart joins us from the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. And let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number, and we'll go to Rotterdam. Susan, you're on.
Hi. This is Susan.
You're on.
And I'm very thankful for the work that both of you do. I just want to tell you a good thing that happened to me. During COVID, a couple of my friends in Rochester started to Zoom together to do their exercises. And they then included me and another woman. And, you know, I live by myself in Rotterdam. That was a real joy to join up. So 3 mornings a week from 9 to 10, we do a pretty rigorous, well, starts out gentle, but we, you know, we do a really good routine. We've all done some yoga, and we're all in our 80s, so we've all done a lot of physical therapy. So we have lots of good exercises. And I realized after a couple of months, like, wow, this has really improved my life. And I started out thinking I might go one morning a week, and now, you know, I'm always there. So I just think if people are listening and they have friends on Zoom and they want to build something into their life, you know, like that, it's really been great. And thank you for your work.
I think that's a spectacular thing that you're doing. I think it's really good for your brain on two levels. One is the physical exercise that you're doing. And the other is, and the reason, one of the reasons why the pandemic was so tough on so many people is that we need social engagement. And so you're getting together with your friends, you're getting that social element, you're getting the encouragement to get up and exercise because it's time to do that and your friends are all doing it. You're getting the actual workout. I think that's spectacular.
Susan, thanks for the call. Why is social engagement important?
We are social animals, and you never know what somebody else is going to say, what comment they're going to make, what bizarre idea they hold dear. And it's interacting with people and, you know, being in a changing environment that keeps the brain stimulated and keeps the dendritic complexity of the brain intact. And without that, the brain just starts to wither.
Interesting. So, okay. So then what you postulate is that you do exercise essentially for your brain, and that's one way to prolong the possible onset of dementia. Yes or no?
Absolutely.
Okay. Is our current predilection for leaping to AI and completely divorcing our brains from making any actual thoughts or decisions, finding your way on a map, for instance, is that a problem long term?
Oh, certainly. There was a study done looking at people who exercised, did an equivalent level of workout of running. One group ran on a treadmill in a gym, and the other group ran outside. And just the, you know, the richness of the environment, or at least it's, you know, presumed that the benefit that the people working out outside had was because of the richness of the environment, because of the changing stimuli, because the brain's got more information coming in, more things to pay attention to, rather than just, you know, looking at the curve of how many ergs you've put out or whatever. That's really strongly beneficial for
the brain. And so when I hear that hearing issues can be also something that will set you on your way to a quicker dementia, it's the same thing?
Exactly.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines. Dr. David Hart joins us, and we'll go to Lolly in Saratoga. Hello, Lolly.
Hi, Dr. Hart. Can you hear me?
I hear you fine.
Hello?
Hello. Hi. Yes.
Hello.
Hi.
So I just wanted to make a quick comment, if I could, about the person that had the facial palsy, you know, the Bell's palsy, that several years ago, I had been having facial sensations and I had been complaining about it. And then I got a pulse, little tinnitus, and I was complaining about that. But then finally, I ended up one day getting a facial palsy. And, you know, so I went to the doctor because I had been seeing neurologists during this time. And the neurologist's first response was, oh, well, gee, you know, let's start you on some steroids. But my GP at that time said, well, gee, let's run a Lyme test. And it ended up that my titers for Lyme were like, you know, off the charts. And so I just kind of wanted to make the comment that if people end up with a, you know, facial palsy, that living where we live in upstate New York and the ticks being rampant with so many diseases, that if they get a facial palsy, I would suggest that they also be getting tested for the tick diseases, you know, for Lyme and other tick diseases.
What do you think, Doc?
Yeah, I think that's true, especially if you're in Rensselaer County or if you're in more rural Albany County. If you're somebody who never leaves the four walls of your apartment, then Lyme testing is probably not so important. But yeah, Lyme absolutely can cause what we call a basilar meningitis. It causes an inflammation at the base of the brain, and that can cause Bell's palsy, or it can cause, eye muscle paralysis or a lot of other things produced by inflammation of the nerves at the base of the brain.
We're joined by Dr. David Hart today from Stratton VA Medical Center. The number is 800-348-2551. Chris is in Del Mar. Chris, you're on.
Hey, hi, Dr. Hart. Thank you for taking my questions. I hope I can ask you two.
Sure.
One is, thank you. Does trazodone put you at risk for Alzheimer's? And the second one would be, do you recommend the COVID vaccination for a tick-borne meningitis? That's the one they've had about a year ago.
Well, the first question, does trazodone put you at risk? I think misusing any medicine is not good for your brain, but trazodone is very commonly used as a sleep aid in the elderly, and I think it is probably less of a risk to the brain than overusing the newer generation sleep aids, which, you know, were really specifically designed for use for 10 days or 2 weeks or something like that, and not longer than that. So I think a low dose of trazodone, in my practice, it's commonly used for helping with sleep. But if it's used for depression or anxiety, no, I don't think that that's a big risk factor for dementia. And then I'm not sure I understood the second question about COVID vaccination and
for someone who had a tick-borne meningitis.
Well, yeah, I think if you've had any kind of brain injury, infection, trauma, then that's another reason to try and, you know, be cautious medically, try and keep yourself away from other things that can hurt the brain, like COVID infection. And so to me, vaccination would seem like a very good idea.
Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. This email from Christine. Love it. Can the doctor define the terms Alzheimer's, dementia, and related disorders?
Sure. So dementia is a category. Many people ask me, what's the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia? Dementia is the category. Whatever your full adult developmental level cognitive capability is, if something happens to you that causes you to decline from that, and it's not from some reversible cause, that just because you've got a bladder infection or just because you have a vitamin deficiency or something like that, that is dementia. So it's what we call an acquired cognitive decline. Alzheimer's is the most common of the dementias. It accounts for probably 65 to 70% of cases of dementia, a lot of times in combination with vascular dementia, a lot of times in combination with dementia with Lewy bodies. And so those three can present in somewhat similar ways. So they're kind of related dementias. And then there are less related dementias like frontotemporal dementia, which tends to be earlier ages of onset, tends to be more behavioral problems than memory problems. But when we use the phrase Alzheimer's and related dementias, I think we're just trying to point out that Alzheimer's is the main bad player, but there's a long list of things which can also cause dementia and need to be considered as well.
Noel in Copaic writes, I have a friend who's getting monthly infusions to remove plaque in the brain. Do you know about this?
I am not sure what they're getting infusions of. Pardon me, they're... Sorry, not enough coffee on a Monday.
I hear you,
it was a
man.
Late train coming back up from the Mets game last night.
You're lucky,
so,
man.
So I apologize. They're no doubt talking about treatment with one of the amyloid-targeting antibodies that we've discussed in the past. So there's a medicine called donanemab, which is given every 4 weeks. And it is an engineered antibody that binds to amyloid in the brain, and it makes it easier for the brain to then break down and destroy that amyloid.
Where do the pieces go when it's destroyed?
It goes into the immune system that's in the brain. The microglia are the white blood cells of the brain. And so they...
Interesting. I mean, if you remove the amyloids and you're already showing symptoms, it's not going to help, is it?
It is not a cure, but we know that with either this medication or with a similar one, lecanemab, both of these are FDA-approved medicines to slow progression of Alzheimer's, that they do two big things. One is that they get amyloid out of the brain to the point that when you do a study called an amyloid PET scan, a large group of these, large proportion of these patients convert from having a positive amyloid scan to a negative amyloid scan. So the amount that's left over is too small to produce what we would consider a positive scan. The more important thing that's been found is that these people hold on to their cognitive functioning longer. They continue to decline over time, but they decline more slowly. And this is one of the other things that was discussed at the big Alzheimer's meeting over the summer, is long-term data from these two medications, finding that the further out people go, the longer people are treated, or farther out they go from being effectively treated, they continue to show benefit. And some of these patients look like they are stabilizing or perhaps even improving. But when you talk about long-term data, you have to talk about what's called selection bias, that you finish the main part of the trial and you're doing an extension. People who are not doing so well tend not to remain in the extension. They tend to drop out if they're not seeing benefit. So you're kind of selecting for the people who are the super responders, so to speak.
But once the damage is done, there's really no rewiring the brain at this point, right?
At this point, there is not. So these medicines are a tremendous boon to us, I think. They're a really great start, but they're only the first step. We need better agents that target amyloid. We need agents that target tau pathology. We need agents that target changes in the microglia. We need a lot of different ways of attacking this problem. And that's why we need basic science research to come up with the mechanisms that we can develop drugs to treat people so you and I can age gracefully.
Dr. David Hart, we only have a few seconds. Basie's already playing. But Jose in Pittsfield says, is there any food that improves brain memory?
I think eating the Mediterranean diet and possibly having the occasional chocolate chip cookie, though the studies don't prove that, to my chagrin.
You know, I had a double Whopper with cheese the other day that I remember vividly. Does that count? All right, man. Hey, good. We'll see you soon, right?
Hopefully so.
Support comes from Woodland Pond at New Paltz, a life plan community at the foot of the Schwangunks, near education, the arts, and outdoor activities. Future residency waitlist available. WoodlandPondNP.org. Well, always great to have Dr. David Hart of Stratton VA Medical Center here, and we'll do it again soon. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our very sharp engineer. Bob Rathman screened the calls. Well done, sir. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we head outdoors, sort of. I mean, we'll be in Studio A, but it's a theater of the mind. Jeremy Hurst of the New York State DEC joins us. We'll see you, too.